I'd like to welcome everybody to today's conference call on telecom immunity. This is Caroline Fredrickson. I'm the director of the Washington Legislative Office of the American Civil Liberties Union. I am joined by a number of experts and litigators who are working on the cases that are proceeding in the Northern District of California involving the telecom company's involvement with wiretapping for the NSA, for turning over customer data to the NSA. Before I go any further, let me just mention that this call is being recorded. And if you have any questions that we can't or you think of later that we don't answer on this call, please call our press line, which is at 202-675-2312. And as I said, I was joined by some expert litigators here with Kevin Bankston, who is a staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Harvey Grossman, who's the legal director of the ACLU of Illinois, Ann Brick, staff attorney for the ACLU of Northern California, and Emily Berman, who's a legal fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice. And before I turn it over to Harvey to talk a little bit about what's going on and what is really at stake in these cases, I just wanted to remind everybody about what brings us here, ultimately. I think you are all well aware of the fact that Congress precipitously passed a legislation called the Protect America Act at the beginning of August in response to the administration's fear-mongering and demagoguery. And that legislation was highly problematic. It expires in early February. It had a six-month sunset. One of the things that it did not do, and which the administration has emphatically stated that it wants the new legislation to do, is to provide immunity for these telephone companies that turned over customer data to the NSA without a warrant. Legislation has now been passed out of the Senate Intelligence Committee, legislation that would, for all intents and purposes, renew the Protect America Act with a few bells and whistles for civil liberties, but not very many, and add on immunity provisions for the telecom companies. It's a highly, highly problematic piece of legislation. It's been subsequently referred to the Judiciary Committee, which will take it up this week, and the issue of telecom immunity will be one of the issues that will be under debate and one of the issues that is most controversial. So let me turn it over to Harvey to tell you what's really at stake and why it is so troubling that Congress would consider providing immunity, essentially for intervening in these court cases and dismissing them without having the opportunity for the cases to be heard by a court, for the customers' concerns to be articulated, and for the legal issues to be analyzed and decided by a judge. So, Harvey Grossman.
Thank you, Caroline. I serve in two capacities in these lawsuits that are consolidated in San Francisco right now. First of all, I represent a group of plaintiffs in Illinois. The name of the litigation that we originally filed is called Terkel versus AT&T, and my clients include Studs Terkel, the writer and oral historian, Dr. Quentin Young, a physician and past president of the American Public Health Association, James Montgomery, an attorney now in private practice and the former corporation counsel of the city of Chicago under Harold Washington, and I might add the first African-American to ever serve in that role, and also the Illinois State Representative, the Democratic Majority Leader of the Illinois House of Representatives, Barbara Flynn Curry. I stress the identity of these people, not because they are more important than any other plaintiffs who are represented in this case, but only that they are, I think, illustrative of the types of Americans who have stepped forward to challenge the acts of government and to challenge the acts of the telecommunications carriers. In a way I think that should resonate with all of us, and that is that these are seasoned, experienced people. They operate in all phases of professional life, and they realize the kinds of interests that are at stake in this litigation. Studs Terkel, I hope some of you might have seen, had a piece that ran in the New York Times a week ago in which he described the kinds of harms that his contemporaries suffered, starting primarily in the 50s during the McCarthy period, because of illegal surveillance, because of government being overly intrusive, and sadly because of the involvement of private industry, of private entities, corporations that affect people's livelihoods and the way that we all are able to carry on our standard of living. By conspiring with government to invade privacy rights, by conspiring with government to violate the law, each of these people has stepped forward because they realize that that is what has occurred in this case, and that the question of the unbridled authority of the executive to contravene federal law, the established course of dealing with these companies that really forms the social compact that exists in this country today about privacy, about exercising political freedoms, has been jeopardized by this administration and by the telco's response to the government. I think it's critical that we not allow those issues to be obfuscated by the telephone company's protestations about possible pecuniary loss, because each of us, I think, has lost a great deal more than what might be threatened by a financial judgment against the telephone companies.
Thank you, Harvey. Now I'd like to turn it over to Ann Brick, who is with the ACLU of Northern California, who's going to talk a little bit about the consolidated cases in the Northern District of California.
Over the month between the time the New York Times first revealed that the government was engaged in warrantless wiretapping and May of 2006, so we're talking December 2005 to about May of 2006, when USA Today revealed that the telephone companies were also turning over their customer calling records to the government. And in between all of the information about the dragnet surveillance that was going on in terms of vacuuming up everybody's emails and telephone calls for the government to engage in data mining, it's not surprising that people all across the country were terribly upset by what they heard. And they turned, as we do, to the courts to seek redress for these massive violations of the law. As a result, some 38 different cases were filed against various telephone companies all across the country. And they all wound up in federal courts in various places across the U.S., and there's a procedure called multi-district litigation, where when you have a lot of lawsuits all involving a particular issue, one of the parties, in this case it was the defendants, the telephone companies, asked the panel on multi-district litigation to take these cases and put them all in one court so that a single judge could master all of the issues so that there wouldn't be inconsistent rulings and so that the cases could be handled sensitively and efficiently. Now, the case that started, the first case against the telephone companies, which you'll be hearing more about from Kevin Bankston, was a suit called Hepting versus AT&T. That was filed in the Northern District of California in front of Chief Judge Vaughn Walker. So when, in the months that followed, all of the rest of these cases got filed, the panel on multi-district litigation considered the arguments of the government about where the cases ought to go, considered the arguments of the telephone companies about where the cases ought to go. They both wanted them either in Virginia or the District of Columbia, or of the plaintiffs who said it makes sense to have Judge Walker hear these cases because he's already ruled on the state secrets issue, which is a key issue in these cases, and the panel on multi-district litigation agreed. And so now all of those cases are in front of Judge Walker. And it is these cases against the phone companies that the phone companies are asking Congress to get rid of by giving them amnesty in this current litigation. The point that I would like to make, at least initially, and then I'll turn it over to others, is that this is not the time to be talking about amnesty for the telephone companies. The issue of whether or not damages are going to be imposed on them are a long ways away. There are many steps that have to be taken and a lot of court rulings that have to be made, not just by Judge Walker, but by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which already has the state secrets issue in front of it. And ultimately, I think we can expect the U.S. Supreme Court to weigh in on this. So now is not the time to short-circuit the judicial process, which is an important process for reaching what these cases are really all about. And what these cases are really all about are whether the telephone companies and the government can ignore the statutory framework that Congress set out for governing the way in which foreign intelligence surveillance is conducted. If we short-circuit that, then the executive's claim that it is above the law, that it can ignore what Congress has said and conduct surveillance on you and me and millions of others of Americans on its own say-so, is going to go unresolved. And it's important that each of the branches of government fulfill its duty. So the executive does surveillance, but within the confines, or it's supposed to do it within the confines of the statutory framework laid out by Congress, and when it doesn't, it should be the courts that adjudicate it. So now isn't the time. The second point that's important to keep in mind about the issue of immunity and damages and whether or not this would be crushing liability is the common sense reminder that if the phone companies have not been helping the government violate the privacy of millions of Americans in violation of the law, then they face no liability whatsoever. If they have been helping the government violate the privacy of millions of Americans, then it's important that they be held to account. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Kevin Bankston from EFF.
Hi, Kevin Bankston from EFF. As Ann mentioned, we are the counsel in Hefting v. AT&T. We are suing AT&T on behalf of all AT&T long-distance and Internet customers, alleging that AT&T has not only provided records of their communications to the government, but also has provided the actual content of their communications, their phone conversations, their emails, their IMs, their web browsing, to the NSA, something that we actually have uncontested record evidence of via a AT&T whistleblower, a technician who actually worked on this program. And I wanted to talk a little bit about how granting immunity in this instance sets a dangerous precedent that threatens the privacy of every American. And to understand that, it's important to look a bit at the history of the law in this area. In the 70s, after Congress had uncovered politically motivated surveillance of political enemies of the White House, they passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to provide clear procedures for when the executive can surveil someone. This was meant to provide the exclusive means by which surveillance could lawfully be conducted in this country. And it was very clear, either a court order was necessary or there were some very narrow exceptions, such as emergencies or a declaration of war, when surveillance could be conducted for a short period of time without a court order. In those instances, the Attorney General would give the carriers a certification that all statutory requirements had been met. This is the regime that the telephone companies have been operating under and cooperating with for over 30 years now. They know exactly what a FISA-compliant court order looks like. They know exactly what a FISA-compliant certification looks like. But apparently, judging based on the language in the Senate Intelligence Bill that contains immunity and the report from that committee, they received, in this instance, assurances that the president had authorized this surveillance, and the president had determined it lawful, and not that the statute had been satisfied. With their experience, with their staffs of lawyers, whose sole job it is to ensure their compliance with these statutes, and has been for 30 years, they knew when they received those pieces of paper that they were being asked to do something that violated Congress's laws based solely on the president's word. Yet FISA's primary purpose, its stated purpose, the sole reason it was passed, was to ensure that the president could not unilaterally decide whom to surveil and when. In the end, it is these companies who control the networks that carry all of our most private communications. And if Congress is sending them the message now that it's okay for you to break the law if the president asks you to, then there is no barrier between the executive and our domestic networks. There is no check against unchecked access by the White House to the communications of you and me and everyone else who uses modern communication systems. So the lawsuits against the telecommunications carriers are critical to establish, to litigate the question and establish whether telephone companies can ignore the law based on the president's say-so. We certainly think they cannot, but this is an issue that the courts need to answer, such that this kind of violation of the law does not happen again. Because if we endorse this conduct looking to the past, we ensure that it will happen again in the future. Now, some have said, well, the companies were simply trying to help the president to fight terrorism in a time of emergency. But we are not talking about the weeks immediately following 9/11, when the president had not yet had a chance to go to Congress and ask for changes to the law that he thought necessary in the war on terror. We are talking about a systematic violation of law that occurred for over half a decade. And indeed, based on new reporting, it appears we are looking at a course of conduct that began even before 9/11. And so the idea that these were companies acting in good faith in a confused emergency period simply doesn't hold water. Nor does the absurd resort to, as we have seen in some editorials, the common law notion of hue and cry. This is, common law means judge created. This is a judge created doctrine that immunizes people who relied on law enforcement representations in an emergency situation. Someone drowning in a lake, or trapped in a burning car, or something else immediate, where if citizen cooperation is not secured, someone might die. Again, that's not what we're talking about now. We're not talking about the moments after 9/11. We are talking about years upon years of systematic violation of the law, whereby telephone companies violated the privacy of all of their customers by handing over their communications and records. And that being the case, those customers deserve their day in court.
Thank you, Kevin. And now we'll turn it over to Emily Berman with the Brennan Center.
Hello. I would like to try to dispel another of the myths that seem to be out there about the immunity issue, that the pending lawsuits risk exposing, through their litigation, classified information related to America's sources and methods of intelligence gathering. The truth is that courts have the capacity to handle classified information carefully and responsibly and to ensure that disclosures do not take place while still allowing plaintiffs to have their rights vindicated through litigation. An array of tools have been developed over the years by the courts themselves, frequently codified after the fact by Congress in approval of those procedures, including a provision within FISA itself that envisions courts handling classified information in the surveillance context. And these tools have been used routinely for years without resulting in unauthorized disclosure of classified material or state secrets. In fact, the information that we do have that is classified has resulted from leaks from within the administration or through whistleblowers and not through the courts themselves. None of the lawyers involved in these suits nor the plaintiffs that filed them want to see information leaked that is not properly in the public sphere as a result of this litigation. The only purpose of the litigation is to hold accountable the telecoms for any violations of law that they may have engaged in and to document those violations if, in fact, they did take place. Retroactive immunity for the telecommunications companies would cut off that process And given the reluctance that the White House has shown in releasing information about what exactly went on in the terrorist surveillance program, these litigations may be the only way that what actually happened is documented. And retroactive immunity would mean that we would never find out.
Thank you. Kevin had wanted to add something.
I wanted to make one clarification to what Emily said regarding whistleblower evidence. The whistleblower evidence in our case, evidence provided by Mark Klein, a former AT&T technician, I should clearly note, the government has said that that information is not classified, and it has chosen not to invoke the state secrets privilege regarding that information. So no information in our lawsuit, no classified information, nor any state secrets privileged information has come out as a result of our lawsuit. And to also clarify, in our lawsuit, we currently had argument in front of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals over whether or not this case can be litigated without harming national security. The government, of course, argues it cannot be litigated. We argue that it can. But that is an issue currently before the courts. It is an issue we are still fighting over a year and a half after filing our case and will likely be fighting over for quite a while now. And so there is simply no indication that the courts are not taking the national security concerns in these cases very seriously and is deliberately considering those issues.
Thank you. And before we turn it over, I did just want to mention, you know, obviously this is a very dangerous situation because we have a Congress that has been unwilling to engage in the appropriate oversight and unwilling to ensure that the issues at stake here are brought to light, that is, the telecom's involvement as well as the administration's illegal behavior. And now Congress, at least through the Senate Intelligence Committee bill, seems to be moving in the direction of cutting off the only other opportunity for oversight through the courts. So our system of checks and balances is being overturned completely. This type of action by Congress is, if not completely unprecedented, then highly unusual to intervene in an ongoing case to legislatively dismiss it. And I think that in itself would be the subject of quite a bit of litigation if that legislation were to pass. So the idea that this is somehow going to stop litigation going forward, I think it would only invite some major constitutional challenges about what is the appropriate role of Congress in a pending lawsuit. So with that, I think we would open it for questions.
Yes, ma'am. At this time, if you have a question, simply press 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Please only press 1 once. If you press it twice, it will remove you from the queue. Our first question, Corey Bowles from Wall Street Journal.
Hi, guys. Thanks for organizing the call today. A few of you have referred to this. I just wanted to perhaps get one of you or more than one of you to explicitly answer the notion floated by some of the lawmakers in the Senate Judiciary Panel that the cases should be allowed to proceed, that the companies shouldn't be on the hook for any ultimate financial penalties against them.
Well, this is Caroline Fredrickson. I think that's it's preliminary. Certainly the provision that's in the bill right now would provide retroactive immunity, and there's no other provision. You know, we'll have to analyze what they bring forward. The critical piece is that these cases get aired and that the telecoms are held accountable. And I think, again, as Ann had mentioned before, doing away with the financial accountability before the cases are litigated in whatever form it happens will be problematic as a precedent for keeping those companies and other companies within the law in the future.
Just a follow-up. Am I still?
Yes.
Right. So it would simply be from a precedent point of view that would concern you as opposed to that being a compromise solution that perhaps lawmakers
no.
could get behind?
No, I didn't say that. I said the cases need to move forward and that telecoms need to be held accountable. I think that is the most pressing need.
But to be clear, not only do the telephone companies need to be held accountable, there are Americans here who are entitled to statutory damages for this violation of their privacy. These are the penalties that Congress reasonably established for just these types of violations of law, and our clients are entitled to that.
I have to say, you know, as somebody who lobbies on the Hill regularly, this is Caroline Krogerson, you know, we are always rubbing up against the multitude, the phalanxes of telecom lobbyists who are up there, and I think members of Congress are feeling awfully a great deal of pity for the sad circumstances the telecoms might find themselves in, are hearing from them on a regular basis as they attend their fundraisers. So I think, you know, we understand why there's so much resonance for some of those arguments, but, you know, as Kevin said, you know, there are people who've had their privacy violated, and that's the most important issue.
This is Harvey Grissom. I'd also like to add that, you know, the other side of the issue, that the first one Kevin identified, of the entitlement of people whose rights have been compromised, whatever it is that's done on the question of damages, it has to also serve as a deterrent. Why do the telephone companies do this, and can they do this freely with impunity? If they can, then they're likely, no matter what it is that the amendments to FISA look like, to do it again. So a get-out-of-jail-free card is something that can only encourage future misconduct. There has to be a penalty. There has to be a deterrent.
Thank you.
Okay, our next question will come from Tom Curry, MSNBC.
Hi. My question is for Caroline Frederickson. You mentioned lobbying members of the Senate. Who can you identify would be the key people to watch? I mean, have you gotten any encouragement at all from Chairman Leahy or the Majority Leader? Can you point to particular people who are important to watch in, as this thing? And also, can you give us a timeline of how you expect this to play out over the next few weeks?
Well, you know, in the Senate, you got to watch everybody. And a lot of moving pieces, and every senator has a fair amount of importance. I think you need to keep your eye on Senator Dodd, who has announced that he'll filibuster a bill that includes telecom immunity and has been followed in short order by all the other Democratic presidential candidates who are in the Senate. So I think that is going to be important and interesting to see that play out. You know, Senator Leahy is obviously very important as the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He has been very strong on this issue up to date. There are cases that have come out of Vermont that he is interested in and wants to see proceed. You know, again, we don't know the exact configuration of what might play out in the Judiciary Committee markup this week, but every single member of that committee is an important vote. We'll be watching all of them, and, you know, Senator Feinstein and Senator Whitehouse sit on the Intelligence Committee as well, and so they'll be a particular focus for all of us who lobby.
Why those two in particular?
They sit on both committees.
I see.
They already
okay.
voted in favor of the Senate Intelligence Bill.
They already voted in favor of it?
Yes.
Okay. And were you, when that happened, what was your, were you surprised? Were you not surprised when that happened?
We were dismayed. You know, it's hard. The Senate Intelligence Committee is such a bizarre entity, and I don't know if any of you have ever tried to get information out of staff from that committee, but they have very strict rules about what information, even if it's not classified, they can share about their committee hearings that they very rarely do in public and on the record, or at least on the record for public consumption. So, you know, to say we were surprised, I wouldn't say we were entirely surprised, but, you know, we were really hoping for stronger results, and we'll continue to try and work with Senator Feinstein and Senator Whitehouse to move them in a better direction. I think they both expressed interest in improving the bill, and the question is, what does that entail, and will they be successful?
Okay. Our next question will come from Christy Smith with FireDogLake.com.
Hi, Caroline. Hi, everybody. I have a practical question, and this is coming from someone who's practiced both in private practice and as corporate counsel, and also on the prosecutorial end of cases. You know, any time when I was a prosecutor, I was asking for information. You know, you came in with a warrant. That warrant had to have all of its T's crossed and its I's dotted. And you still had corporate counsel for companies, you know, for hospital records, for phone records, coming in, fighting whatever subpoena we were sending out. making sure that they had a court order on the record covering them for liability purposes for releasing any information at all whatsoever. And that was true across the board for any company, big or small, in terms of liability considerations for corporate counsel. That's what you do for your client as corporate counsel. And I am baffled by the mindset that went on with this, not for the short term, because as you guys know, the FISA law has an emergency provision built into it that was expressly provided by Congress in terms of, you know, an emergency provision for an emergency period of time where warrants and information requirements don't apply. But this clearly, you know, went on for over 5 years in terms of you know, the no warrant provision going on with this. And I'm baffled by the corporate mindset on this because it is antithetical to everything I know about corporate practice. And I'm wondering if you all have any insight on that. I would love to know.
Well, I think you make a really important point here, and that is, A, that the telephone companies have very fine lawyers advising them, that they consult them all the time, and B, that they are very used to dealing with requests for information that come from the government, and they know what a proper court order or what a proper certification looks like, and they know what an improper one looks like as well. Judge Walker said when he issued his ruling on state secrets in the Hepting case that no reasonable telephone company would think that what they were being asked to do complied with FISA. So in considering this whole issue of amnesty or immunity, I think it's important to keep in mind that these telephone companies knew exactly what they were doing when they did it.
This is Caroline. Sorry, I just say one quick thing that I would point you to the National Journal article that just came out on Friday, which was fascinating discussion of Quest in particular and the negotiations with the government prior to 9/11. It certainly looks like the government was using the telecoms access to very large government contracts as one of the bases for getting them to comply.
This is Harvey Grossman. I to second Carolyn's point briefly, there's a very complex relationship between a highly regulated industry and an executive branch, and the notion that immunity, first of all, should be granted on such a short time frame. I mean, there ought to be a full public exposition of what these relationships are about before immunity is given to an industry for knowing and blatant violations of the law. You described a relationship that you would expect to exist between a corporation and its counsel or her their counsel. And, you know, the lawyers who assist the ACLU in this case, who are private corporate, who do commercial litigation all the time and advise corporations, wonder those same questions. And they wonder about issues like indemnification. Did the administration suggest, did NSA suggest that they would indemnify these companies? That would be the kind of responsible questions that would go on between a consult seeking to protect the interests of a corporation and government in this instance, where there was clear noncompliance with existing law. What is the extent of the insurance coverage that that this industry and these individual companies have? And do knowing violations, are they exempted from the coverage, or are they covered nevertheless? So when the companies come before the American public and come before the Congress and try to establish their bona fides, their entitlement to immunity here, I think that there's a lot of questions that are left open.
Okay, our next question will come from Pamela Hess with AP.
I have kind of a basic legal question, if you can explain this to me. I'm guessing that because of the secrecy in these cases, you don't exactly know whose records have been eavesdropped on. So what's the standing in filing any of these cases? Are there any that you actually know that someone in particular's rights have been violated?
Hi, Pamela. This is Kevin Bankston with EFF. To be clear, in our lawsuit, we are alleging that AT&T has handed over the records and communications of most, if not all, of its customers.
Mm.
But to the extent secrecy would preclude a standing us from establishing standing,
mm-hmm.
that is an issue that is currently being litigated.
Okay.
And Judge Walker in San Francisco found that we had made allegations that gave us standing because we had alleged this coverage of most or all AT&T customers.
And when
to be clear, we are not alleging, nor do we need to allege or establish, that all AT&T customers have been targeted for surveillance, or that NSA analysts have listened to their phone calls or read their emails.
Mm-hmm.
All we need to establish in our case
is that the information was handed over.
The information was disclosed by AT&T, and so we are not seeking any particular details about how the NSA targets terrorists.
Okay. With regard to the National Journal article, I think that's I haven't read it, but I assume it has to do with the Quest case.
Yes.
Is there any other information? Because obviously this guy has something to gain from saying this, and so he can be either validly or not undermined in argument by government saying, look, he's just trying to save his ass and saying this stuff. You can't prove it's true. So he's the only guy. Is there anybody else that's suggesting that this stuff was pre-9/11?
That's the best source, so far as I know. But it's an interesting one because it's in his legal filings. And if I remember the story, I think the general counsel from Quest has also said that was true.
Right. Okay. Thanks.
Okay, our next question will come from Lawrence Hurley with Los Angeles Daily Journal.
Hi, my question is about the possible compromises in the Senate in terms of possibility of indemnification or even a cap on damages, which Senator Feinstein was talking about last week, because she's worried about the amount of money that the companies could be liable for. So I was just wanted your thoughts on which would be preferable if you can't just put a stop to total immunity.
Certainly from the lobbying point of view, which is my focus mostly, none of them is preferable. It's all premature, and I assume the litigators would agree with that. But if anyone is worried at the end of the day, if it comes out that the telecoms have indeed violated people's rights at such magnitude that they're going to go out of business, I think then Congress can look at that at that point in time and figure out whether it needs to provide some assistance. I think at this point, before the cases have even been allowed to proceed, it would be extremely troubling to have them cut off in any way or to have negative incentives placed on the telephone companies, but again, on any company that's told by the president to break the law. I think we should not encourage the president's own unique interpretations of what our statutory obligations are.
But in this case, it would allow you to proceed with all the cases and get all the facts out. And you said earlier, it's not the damages that you're most interested in anyway.
Right, but as a legislative process, there is no reason to do this now because the litigation is in its infancy, in essence, and there's such a long road to travel before we get to the point of damages. As Anne pointed out, this, most likely to proceed to the Supreme Court, the government's litigating every different element of this, from standing to state secrets. And so I think our position is there really shouldn't be any compromise because the litigation has years ahead of it before it comes to a point of damages being awarded.
This is Kevin Bankston from EFF. I agree that it is premature to be considering any of these options. Certainly, some middle ground would be preferable to a blanket immunity that kills all of the cases. But I think it's too early for legislative action here. But I also think there are two different perspectives to look at this, a policy perspective and the perspective of my clients. From a policy perspective, indemnification, for example, takes the phone companies completely off the hook and removes the incentive against future lawbreaking. The importance of these cases is not only to vindicate my clients' rights, but to ensure that the phone companies don't do this again. And taking them off the hook via indemnification short-circuits that process. Looking at this with the lawyer hat on, representing my clients, indemnification would address their needs. It would provide them relief, but their main interest here is to vindicate the law, and indemnifying the phone companies fails to hold them accountable and ensure that this kind of conduct doesn't happen again.
This is Ann Brick. I just want to add one quick thought to that policy point that Kevin made, and that's how important it is to keep in mind that the way FISA is structured and the way surveillance operates in the real world, the phone companies are really the only ones in a position to know whether or not the government is acting within the statutory mandate or not. And if we give them a free pass this time when they didn't say no and they should have, it will happen again, and chances are we'll never even know about it.
Okay, our next question will come from Arnando Lawrence from Top Left.
Good afternoon, everyone. Caroline, I want to ask you specifically, because you're working up on the Hill on this, no one's mentioned the Wyden Amendment. I know that's not directly related to the telco immunity situation, but to what degree is the Wyden Amendment, which if it's in there, I think Bush said he would veto any bill that included the Wyden Amendment, is that either a poison pill in this legislation or perhaps a bargaining chip to make sure that telco immunity does not come through?
Well, it's an interesting question. I don't think they're really tradable points. The Wyden Amendment, for the others who may not be up on it, requires a warrant when the government is targeting an American overseas under the NSA surveillance program. The administration has stated it would veto legislation over numerous factors. I don't know how much weight to really put on it in this regard. Just those of you who read statements of administration policy know that they have different phrases for whether it's the president, I will recommend a veto, or it's some other language. I don't think we have a sense yet of how serious they are about this. But, I suspect it's more posturing than anything else. It's hard to imagine what kind of a burden that really places on the government. So I don't know. We certainly don't see either one as a bargaining chip for the other. But you're right to point out the rest of the bill, because the rest of the bill is obviously from the point of view of the civil libertarians very, very troubling in authorizing essentially the president's warrantless wiretapping program with a new name and a fig leaf.
Carol, can I just follow up? Because at least as far as I know, the Bush administration has not said the same thing about telco immunity. Am I wrong on that? Have they threatened to veto over the telco immunity?
Well, it's hard to veto a bill over something that's not in it. I don't think they have said that. They have said that they absolutely are demanding that immunity be in a bill. But would the president veto it if it arrived without that particular provision? I can't tell you at this point. I don't think they've framed it that way, but there are even if for example it was stripped out on the floor, to, Chris Dodd is successful with his filibuster, so then they strip out this provision and then send it through. There are so many different ways to make sausage in Congress, and we would be awfully worried that it will come out some other way. I think. As those who are in this room know full well, at the end of the last Congress, the telecom immunity provision popped up in all sorts of different bills, and it was essentially a full-time undertaking for our lobbyist, Tim Sperponi, who's in the room, tracking down where the immunity provisions were popping up in a variety of bills coming out of a variety of different committees and appropriations bills and so forth. So I think even if we were to be successful in stripping it here, it's definitely the game's not over.
Thanks.
Okay, our next question will come from Ted Gotch with Telecommunication Reports.
Yes, hello. I was just wondering, obviously Thursday, the Senate Judiciary is marking the Senate spies reform bill up, and just wondered how, you sort of just referenced Carolyn just sort of referenced that obviously there's no shortage of opportunities to reintroduce language, any kind of language, if you really, someone really wants it to be included badly enough. But with the reality that a hearing was held last week in Senate Judiciary, and certainly there were a lot of folks who, you know, seemed to hold firm, speaking of Leahy and Specter specifically, on in adding the immunity language. How important do you see Tuesday's event, excuse me, Thursday's hearing on the markup on the bill influencing whether this actually happens this year or not?
Well, you know, it's very important in the sense that a lot of the other senators off the committee will look to the leadership of the members who are more informed than they are on these particular issues. And so I think the debate that happens in the committee, and if there's a vote, we don't know if there'll be a vote on this specific issue, will be hugely influential. And, you know, again, if the Senator Feinstein modify her position, I think that will, again, be enormously influential on other members of the Senate. So, you know, we're not sure that this is going to be where the debate will be joined, in the sense of that there'll be an amendment offered, but it will certainly be a place where there's a debate that takes place.
Okay, our next question will come from Ryan Single with Wired.
I was wondering if you guys can switch us a little bit to something that Feinstein mentioned in the report that came out of the Senate Intelligence. Is she seemed to be indicating that she had problems with a program, a surveillance program that wasn't covered under currently under FISA or the new FISA Amendment Act, and she seemed to be referring to a call records program. It's not totally clear what that she was mentioning, but as you all know, the call records aren't considered. You know, looking at call records isn't considered electronic surveillance if the government's doing it. Is that something that you all are working with Feinstein? She seemed to indicate she wanted to have some amendments when this bill hits the floor.
Well, there are a lot of thoughts about potential amendments swirling around, so I don't know on this particular one that we have worked with Feinstein yet directly. We've been focused, we're a pretty large advocacy organization, but, you know, you still have limited resources. We focus on telecom immunity and on ensuring or trying to ensure that there are individual warrant requirements and not some kind of reauthorization of a warrantless wiretapping program. So that's where we've directed our energies, not on that particular issue. But we'll definitely look into it. I'm not familiar with her statement on that.
And if I could follow up, can someone explain how this is an initiative wanted by the administration? Why have they seemed to be much more successful in a Democrat-controlled Congress than they were in when they pushed for this before 2007?
Well, that is the question that I think we ask ourselves every single day when we wake up and we say, "Why now? Why the Democrats?" Honestly. There are a lot of possible answers for that. One is that when the Protect America Act passed, the Democrats basically stumbled severely. They bungled the process, and I don't know that they really anticipated how bad the legislation would be that they allowed to pass. The major problem that we face with this issue and with any number of other issues, but running the gamut from restoring habeas corpus to closing Guantanamo to banning torture to discussing these issues around the confirmation of Judge Mukasey, is that the Democrats are so weak-kneed when it comes to issues involving the war on terror. We bring them polling results, we show them data that the public has moved beyond. The public is now highly skeptical of the administration and its claims of the need for Americans to give up our cherished civil liberties and constitutional rights in order to facilitate a variety of programs that the president has advanced. And yet the Democrats seem to be paralyzed with fear. And, you know, I would say that one of the best illustrations of this was before the habeas corpus legislation was due to be marked up in the House, when John Boehner floated a talking point that said that habeas corpus, that providing habeas corpus was providing terrorists with a Bill of Rights. And that stopped the markup. I am serious that that stopped the markup, as if the Democrats have never been called soft on terror by this administration. But somehow, even though the American public doesn't buy it, the Democrats are still buying it and, you know, buying it cheap.
Thanks.
Okay, now our next question will come from Ann Beagle Communications Daily.
Hi, this is Ann Beagle. I have a couple of questions on the political dynamics. With the markup coming up Thursday, it looks like things are poised to kind of collapse like a house of cards like they did last summer. Caroline, what's your do you have a vote count? What's your sense of what could happen?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Ann, that you frame it that way. I think we see it as a debacle, but not because the bill will necessarily collapse, but because two members of the Judiciary Committee on the Democratic side have already voted in favor of it.
Mm-hmm.
So our vote count, unless they change their minds, is that the bill comes out of committee. And the real question is, will amendments be successful?
Right. That, I guess, I was thinking of Senate-wide.
Well, Senate-wide, I mean, I think you probably know what the vote looked like the last time.
Mm-hmm.
But the Senate Democrats, a number of them voted in favor of the administration bill, so that's obviously an issue.
Right.
Now, with Senator Dodd's filibuster,
right?
You know, that's very interesting, and
yeah.
I think has had a lot of, I think his statement and his a force of his efforts have been very influential on his colleagues. Obviously, the other presidential candidates have followed after. And I think there'll be any number of other Democrats who will see that that is not only good policy, but good politics.
Mm-hmm.
It's no love lost phone companies in this country.
Right, of course
But I think, you know, the essence for us is that we want to make sure that even if there's an opportunity and a successful outcome with the telecom immunity, that the bill itself is still highly flawed. And the worry is that it could still move forward under those lights. And so we're trying to remind Democrats that as much as they're focused on telecom immunity, they also need to focus on whether or not individual warrants or some kind of protections for Americans' privacy rights are provided.
Okay. And must a bill pass before Congress leaves, before the
election? No, nothing. You know, the sunset for the Protect America Act expires in early February,
okay.
But nothing actually would have to be passed because
okay.
I think people tend to forget this, but if the Protect America Act expired, FISA would be the law of the land with all of the same protections it's provided for three decades, a system that a number of experts from within the government, like Jack Comey, have said was a very effective system for processing warrants. And I think that would be the law of the land. We'd be far, far preferable
mm-hmm.
to the Protect America Act.
So it's possible this whole thing could just, you know, completely be a spaghetti strand. You know, nothing would happen if
well,
there's enough opposition.
Honestly, from the ACLU point of view,
yeah.
that would be the very best outcome for our Constitution and for civil liberties, to
okay.
see the whole thing collapse. But I'm not too optimistic about that.
Thank you.
Because again, the Democrats are in terror of the war on terror.
Okay. Next, we have Martin Bosworth with Scholars and Rogues.
My question was largely answered by Christy Smith's question about how knowledgeable the telecom lawyers are about these procedures. So I'll pass on that. But thank you, though.
Thank you.
Okay. Then our next question will come from Nick Giuliano from Raw Story.
Hi there. I remember somebody mentioning earlier the possibility of whatever Congress ends up passing being challenged in the courts itself, and I was hoping you could maybe expand a little bit on what form that would take and you know, where we could move forward if Congress ends up moving a bill through.
Well, this is Kevin Banks, and we certainly can't preview our litigation strategy, but I can say that we see serious constitutional questions with Congress granting immunity here and interfering in cases that are currently pending before the judicial branch. And so we will vigorously litigate against the application of any immunity in our cases. But I'm afraid I can't tell you how we're going to litigate that.
Can you give me any idea, are there any sort of historical corollaries of something similar like this, you know, that would maybe illuminate what sort of path that would follow without necessarily giving away your strategy?
Well, no, in that the immunity currently being proposed is unparalleled historically. We've not seen Congress intervening in this manner in any kind of case alleging statutory and constitutional violations.
All right, great. Thanks very much.
Okay, our next question, Fabian Gorman from Baltimore Sun.
Hi, I was just wondering, we've talked a lot about the Senate. What is your read on what is going on the House side these days?
It's an interesting question. I think the same thing has been going on the House side that's been going on since they pulled the bill from the floor, which is they're trying to figure out whether or not they can pass a bill and trying to count votes.
Do you have any sense as to whether the Senate bill has influenced any of the thinking on the House side? Because I remember talking with some folks after they pulled the bill who suggested that they were kind of waiting to see exactly what the Senate turns up and sort of where that goes.
Well, you know, it's surprising how little conversation actually happens between the two houses of Congress.
Right.
So we haven't really seen that happening, which is fine from our point of view, because even though we didn't like the House bill, it's quite superior to the Senate bill.
Thanks.
Okay, our final question will come from Pamela Hess with AP.
One of the things that the telecoms are saying, and it was in all the letters that they sent back, is that they don't think that they should be put in a position of having to judge the legality of the letters that come to them. Do you think that there's anything to that? I can see an argument that, you know, the Patriot Act created the national security letters, and September 11th happens, and they're getting these, you know, sort of unusual requests from the White House, and how are they supposed to be able to tell the difference between them?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. You wonder why they have such large legal departments and outside counsel hired. You know, that's preposterous, if I could put it bluntly. They do have to deal with court orders all the time or requests for information that, if they're not proper, will subject them to penalties of different sorts in a variety of different venues, from state to federal court. So I think they scrutinize these things with a fine-tooth comb.
Mm-hmm.
They know the law probably better than most of the government officials do, who are sending them the orders or other requests for information. So,
do you have any insight then as to how this first got started? How did it slip past the censors the first time?
I don't think it slipped past anybody. I think there was obviously a conscious decision to participate in what they knew and expected to be in violation of statutory obligations, which I think Kevin and Ann have been describing.
Mm-hmm. And can you put yourself in their shoes? Why would they agree to do that after, you know, so many years of having FISA being the sort of the ruling legislation? Why would they open themselves up to that vulnerability?
I think that's what the cases will help illustrate. Why did they do that? Was it for financial gain? Was there government contracts at issue? Did they get paid for the information? Or were they told they'd get indemnification at the end of the day? I don't know. Ann and Kevin, I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that. But, I mean, that's exactly what the cases would allow to be brought forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, this is Kevin. I think ultimately your question is one that's best posed to the companies and one that will be answered in the litigation if it's allowed to continue.
At this time, there are no further questions.
Right. Well, thank you all for participating. This call will be posted on our website. And again, if you have any follow-up that you would like to do with us, any further questions, please call our press line, which is 202-675-2312.
And also, this is Kevin Banks, not being an ACLU staffer, but an EFF staffer. Let me give you some contact information for me as well. I am traveling, and I am in D.C. right now, although based in San Francisco. I can be reached on my cell phone. It is 415-748-8126.
So thank you all.
This officially ends the conference. Have a great afternoon.